I next met with Dr. Carey, and to begin, she followed up on an issue addressed by Dr. Blackwell, the use of genomic assays, including the 21-gene recurrence score, the BCI or breast cancer index, the nanostring Prosigna assay, all in patients with ER-positive HER2-negative disease, both at diagnosis and after 5 years of endocrine therapy.
So there's really two questions in ER-positive HER2-negative disease that we want answered. The first is, at the very beginning, is there a benefit of adding chemotherapy to endocrine therapy? And then 5 years later is there a benefit for continuing to 10 years as opposed to stopping after five? And the truth is that the assays that are out there provide information for both of those questions. The problem is that it looks like some of them, you know, there's more data about chemotherapy with the recurrence score, but the identification of late relapses may be a little bit better done by the BCI or by the nanostring Prosigna test. And so I think we're going to have to come to some resolution of this, hopefully through kind of comparative effectiveness sort of evaluation, sort of like what Mitch Dowsett has done with TransATAC. So he did a comparison of BCI versus recurrence score. He did a comparison of PAM50 versus recurrence score versus, you know, IHC4 markers. I think when we put them all together in a data set like that, we may get a better handle on this.
It does seem, though, at least if you read some of these papers, I mean, it doesn't seem like they have quite the same kind of data we have in the early setting in terms of the benefits of treatment, particularly in the early stage with chemo, in terms of benefits of extending hormones at 5 years. But it does, just to naive eyes like mine, when I read those papers, it looks like they can, first of all, identify people who perhaps have such a low risk of recurrence from the years 5 to 10 that they really couldn't benefit very much from therapy. But even more so, it looks like there's a group that can be identified with, you know, maybe a 15 or 18% recurrence rate between years 5 and 10. Do you buy into those data? And if you could discriminate those two groups, do you think it would help in decision-making?
I do think it would help in decision-making. You know, this is a burning clinical question because we commit patients to 5 years of endocrine therapy, you know, with some quality of life and physical cost. I think the data are fairly compelling that several of the assays can differentiate a group that untreated do very well, you know, from the 5 years on, and another group that don't. And I don't think it's unreasonable to take the leap of saying those who seem to have a high risk of recurrence after the fifth year are those in whom ongoing endocrine therapy, particularly in patients who are having bone health issues or quality of life issues. I mean, I think making decisions based on an assay like that is a very thoughtful thing to do. I actually find these data compelling and consistent.
How do you, for practical purposes, go about deciding whether or not to extend therapy first in the patient who's premenopausal and is still premenopausal at 5 years, and second when the postmenopausal situation?
You know, the patient who's premenopausal and still premenopausal, so historically my approach to them was either to continue tamoxifen or not. I think with the soft text data, my decision-making about the endocrine approach up front may vary, right? In the higher risk patient clinically, I tend to use AIOS, you know, aromatase inhibitor and ovarian suppression. In the lower risk stage one or early stage two, I would use tamoxifen still. I think when you get to the fifth year, if they are still premenopausal and you've had them on tamoxifen, I would probably continue them there. Now, if they're on an AI and ovarian suppression, we haven't yet had to deal with that. And I hope that by the time we get there, we'll have some data from some of the MA17 and other long-term studies about ongoing aromatase inhibitors after the fifth year.
So let's talk about another topic covered at the meeting, management of ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease. And we discuss another case from Dr. Alan Astrow, a 58-year-old woman who received prior adjuvant chemotherapy and then tamoxifen for 5 years and then switched to letrozole but discontinued it due to tolerability issues. She then developed metastatic disease a couple years later off therapy. How do you think through the issue of choice of endocrine therapy and whether to add the CDK inhibitor palbociclib?
I have to say that my own practice for patients who are in the first line setting like this is to add in palbo, particularly if I'm going to use letrozole. In part, that's because we can and that it's generally well tolerated it does change the way you have to monitor patients. So it does change the relationship of the patient to the disease and the relationship of the patient to you. And so, you know, it is a little bit more of an investment. That said, there's consistency now with the phase 2 study and now a phase 3 study in the pretreated setting with a significant prolongation of progression-free survival. And I think since it's approved in this setting, it's actually, there's a reasonably compelling argument to use it. That said, I am very troubled by the fact that we really don't have a selection strategy for the drug. And now with the pretreated setting data with fulvestrant, this is a drug clearly that's active, but it's also clearly not active in everybody. And it's very expensive and it does have additional toxicity. And I think we're sadly in need of a selection strategy beyond hormone receptors.
So I want to get into the issue of what you pair it up with. But first, can you describe a clinical scenario where you would not add palbo to, let's say, first-line therapy of metastatic ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, both patients who present de novo with metastatic disease or recurrence? Do you, at this point, pretty much routinely turn to palbo, or are there some people where you might just use hormones?
You know, it's a difficult one because we really don't have a strategy at this point. I think that patients who have significant comorbidities or in whom I think the additional toxicity of palbo may be difficult for them or the additional monitoring is going to be a burden, you know, at this point, without a compelling evidence of a survival advantage, we can acknowledge that there are practical choices that can be made. So that's probably the main criterion I would use. And I'm sort of struggling because I do have patients, you know, a patient I saw recently who's 7 years on single agent AI at the first line setting. So had I committed her to palbo up front, which nowadays I probably would, she's somebody who would have been taking a drug and having to come for frequent monitoring for 7 years without a detectable benefit.
You mentioned the issue of the expense, and of course, that's a big topic in oncology in general. There's a big article in the New York Times about copays recently. What's your experience been with palbo in terms of that issue of copays?
You know, I think it varies. We're a state institution, so we actually have a fair number of patients who are on charity care or in the uninsured setting. And so some of our options are sort of limited. They've actually been pretty good about providing patient assistance. And we have found that in the pretreated setting, we're starting to get approvals coming through, depending on the insurance company. But some of the patients still have a significant personal burden that needs to be addressed.
So we also got into the issue of what happens after palbo. And going back to the case that we were talking about before of the patient who relapses on anastrozole, and the most common choice of therapy there was fulvestrant and palbo. And we said, well, assume the patient has a response to that, but then has asymptomatic disease progression, you still want to use endocrine therapy. And here we saw a lot of people, including you, turning to everolimus, in this case with exemestane. But another option that a small fraction of the audience selected was to keep the palbo going and then switching the endocrine therapy. What do we know from a research point of view about second-line endocrine therapy?
Well, you know, I think there's two elements. One is the exemestane everolimus is a very reasonable and data-supported approach in this setting. Continuing palbo after progression on palbo is an interesting idea with the concept underlying it that if there's intact RB, then if you're going to be targeting the endocrine cascade, then co-targeting RB would also be a useful thing to do. To be honest, I think that's an interesting theoretical comment and consideration. I don't know that in the clinical scenario, since there's no data for it, that I would advocate for it. I do think it's a worthwhile thing to study, though.
Are you using everolimus nowadays, and is this a situation where you're using it?
It is, actually. I do use it. You know, I have to say that particularly in older patients, I think it's uncommon for them to actually tolerate 10 milligrams of it. But I have quite a few patients who have had long times of disease control on, you know, 5 or 7.5 milligrams.
And, you know, initially there was a lot of concern about tolerability, specifically mucositis. How has that played out in your practice currently?
It is an issue. I think, you know, dose modification is appropriate and early institution of appropriate oral care. You know, our nurses have this whole paradigm, seems to help. So I have to say, it seemed to be more of an issue when we were less sort of familiar with the drug and before people kind of came up with strategies and paradigms. It seems to be better tolerated in part because people are handling it more assertively than they were.
It's always difficult to compare therapies indirectly, but do you have any sense in general about the magnitude of benefit that everolimus adds to hormonal therapy compared to, you know, CDK inhibitor like Calbo?
It is really hard to tell. You know, I think there's certain amount of excitement because progression-free survival doubling, which was seen in both of the Palbo studies, the absolute magnitude was different. You know, one was 4 months to 9 months and the other was 10 to 20. I mean, obviously the setting matters, which is why we always do these cross-trial comparisons with great hesitation. But if you just say what in general was the effect, it is hard to discount a doubling of progression-free survival, which really is relatively uncommon and was not seen in the everolimus study.
What are some of the clinical trial concepts that are looking at both everolimus and mTOR inhibition, as well as CDK inhibitors that are ongoing right now, particularly in terms of using Palbo, that you think are going to be interesting to see over the next few years?
Well, you know, there's a lot of them. I think there's the question of whether the mTOR inhibition and CDK4/6 inhibition and endocrine therapy, whether the sort of throwing a blanket over the entire pathway and cascade will be useful. There's several studies that are looking at that. I think the most intriguing studies right now, of course, are the move of both drugs into the adjuvant setting and seeing whether or not this actually improves cure rate when added to endocrine therapy.
Any sense when we might see some results from these adjuvant studies?
Don't hold your breath. It's going to be a while, right? Because this is hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer. And these are all ongoing studies.
Are these like massive studies?
Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, the everolimus study is a SWOG study, is still accruing patients. The Palbo, there's a couple of Palbo studies that are either about to start or are really early.
You mentioned the issue of markers or predictors of benefit from either one of these therapies. Anything that you've seen in particular that looks encouraging? I'll take that long pause as not too much.
I know. Well, you know, the problem is, of course, that we're not as smart as we think we are, right? So you may remember the phase 2 Palbo study that generated the FDA approval. It was 100% reasonable the way it was originally designed, which was a small cohort of unselected hormone receptor positive HER2 negative breast cancer patients, and then a larger definitive cohort, they thought, of subjects selected by evidence of RB being active, specifically cyclin D1 and P16. And so it was in an interim analysis when they realized that the unselected group was actually outperforming the selected group, that they kind of changed the cohorts and revised the study. So I do think that there are a number of ways of trying to tease out whether RB is intact and targetable that people need to look at. You know, I don't know what's going to be the most valuable.
So we also talked at the meeting about new CDK inhibitors, and one in particular, abemaciclib. Maybe you can talk a little bit about it. I was really intrigued because you have all this biology talking about synergy between CDK inhibitors and endocrine therapy, and this agent seems to have benefit even by itself. What do we know about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. It's another CDK4/6 inhibitor. It's a little bit earlier in clinical development. The however is that it's different, right? It has different toxicity. It has a little bit less myelosuppression, a little more GI toxicity. So more of the things that annoy the patient more than the doctor. And it does. This is one of the ones that actually does seem to have some single agent activity. So it may be a little bit different. It may be better. It may be harder to incorporate. I think that remains to be seen. But I think there's a fair amount of excitement about this class of drugs and also an emerging sense that they aren't all the same. And so we're going to have to not make too many assumptions of total transferability of the drugs from one to another.
Where you mentioned the fact that it's not as farther along in development, what are some of the trial concepts that are being looked at? And is it being looked more in combination with hormones or by itself?
It is mostly being looked at in combination, I think, for the obvious reasons. It wouldn't surprise me. I actually don't know if there are single agent trials out there. I'd have to look. But in general, I think these are mostly being looked at in combination with endocrine therapy.
Anything that came out at San Antonio, I see there were a few papers and posters on CDK inhibitors. There was one poster, I think, on abemaciclib that looked at it combined with not just endocrine therapy, but also HER2-targeted therapy. I think it's pretty early data. But what about the patient with ER-positive, HER2-positive disease? Where do you see the CDK inhibitors fitting in there? And I guess indication-wise, you can't do it right now.
No, you can't do it indication-wise, but it actually, I mean, from a biologic standpoint, you know, it's actually a pretty sensible approach, I think. And I do think, now that you mentioned, I do think that is being tested, and I support that because, you know, again, the one group that pretty consistently RB may not be intact in is triple negative, but I think in HER2-positive, ER-positive, it frequently is. And I think, you know, we're also so often giving, if you think about it, the data regarding co-targeting ER and HER2, clearly there's been, you know, a couple of trials that all show pretty consistently significant benefits of co-targeting over endocrine alone. But, you know, the performance is not that great. The patients don't do that well. So this is still a more aggressive group of tumors than ER-positive, HER2-negative tumors. So it may well be that a third targeted agent may circumvent that. We are getting into the era of multiple targeted agents, and so we're going to be back to needing some strategies for selection beyond just hormone receptors and HER2. But there is a biologic rationale.
So I want to move on and talk about another topic from the meeting, one that you were focused on, the management of triple negative breast cancer, both in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant, and metastatic setting. And the first thing that we brought up as an issue is the concept of BRCA testing in patients with breast cancer in general, and particularly in triple negative disease. Can you talk about what your own approach is to that?
Well, you know, BRCA testing for germline BRCA 1 or 2 in triple negative disease, the current paradigms actually have shifted somewhat. So in my own institution, a triple negative patient, regardless of family history, who's under 65, undergoes clinical genetics counseling and discussion of germline testing. And that's because of the association of triple negative with BRCA 1 carriage in particular. So they've shifted, you know, in otherwise unselected patients, it's basically premenopause. But in triple negative, the bar is set a little bit lower. And it's really those who are under 65 because of that association and because the additional risk that's conferred by having triple negative disease. I think the question of why do we test is clearly a point of contention. So that's testing in order to identify hereditary breast cancer with all the implications that has for surgical management of the breast, surgical management of the ovaries, and family counseling. The separate question that's kind of emerging is whether there's evidence to treat patients differently who have breast cancer, whether their own systemic therapy strategies ought to differ for those with germline carriage of BRCA 1 or 2 and those who do not. The data at the moment are around two basic premises. The first is whether or not chemotherapy choices should differ. And I think at the moment, there's less data for that. I think the metastatic setting TNT study got people very interested in the idea of higher sensitivity to platinating agents in the first-line setting compared to a taxane, which is the usual approach. In those with germline BRCA carriage, there was about a 70% response rate to platinum compared to 30-something percent with docetaxel. I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to take into account when you're making choices about chemotherapy drugs. But the truth is, in that study, there was a crossover, and overall survival was the same, whether you got the platinum first or the taxane first. So I think it's less important than some of the other variables like toxicity of the two drugs. I think the other category that people, of course, are interested in are the PARP inhibitors, because PARP inhibition is much more associated with effectiveness in germline carriers than in sporadic triple negative breast cancer. But that's still a story that's being written, and there are studies ongoing in this.
One other thing about BRCA testing I was curious about, what kind of BRCA testing do you do? I wasn't aware there's a panel that goes beyond BRCA, and then there's just BRCA itself. What kind of BRCA testing do you use?
Well, we typically use BRCA 1 and 2 unless there's clearly a family history suggesting, you know, some, you know, Lee Fraumeni or something else. There are other panels, and we not infrequently have patients come in who have had these much broader panels, but of course, oftentimes we don't quite know what to do with the 23 other things that come in. And so I think it does create a bit of a problem. So in fact, the choice of what's tested for is really driven by the family history. And just conventional breast, ovarian, cyst susceptibility, we still do just BRCA 1 and 2.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about neoadjuvant therapy of triple negative breast cancer. First of all, you alluded to this before, but do the BRCA results change whether you use a platinum in the neoadjuvant setting?
No, not at this point.
And as long as we're talking about neoadjuvant therapy of triple negative disease, I'm curious what your thoughts were. You mentioned the German group, which does so much great research on neoadjuvant therapy. They had put out there a trial that showed some results demonstrating that nab-paclitaxel seemed to have greater efficacy in the neoadjuvant setting than cremaphore-paclitaxel. Any thoughts about that data set and kind of what you think it means?
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting data set. So in that GBG study, which was somewhat unconventional chemotherapy backbone of a liposomal doxorubicin and paclitaxel and Bev, patients received or didn't receive carboplatin. The overall trial did show some, you know, modest augmentation of pathologic complete response with the addition of the platinum, but in the triple negative subset, it was augmented. And it was, I think it was a little more than 15% absolute difference. I think this is a very interesting finding because of the association of pathologic response to outcome, but of course they don't have outcome data. And if you sort of try and calculate the kind of benefit this might create if it was confirmed, you know, it's about a hazard ratio of about 0.8 in favor for event-free survival. But again, this is 275 or so patients as a subset within a study without any survival data, and clearly with additional toxicity. That's the other issue, is that the nab-paclitaxel versus paclitaxel, there was a much higher discontinuation rate of the chemotherapy altogether and a higher toxicity, as expected. So I think you have a little bit more efficacy if PCR is your endpoint at the risk of additional toxicity. We don't know whether it's going to translate into event-free survival. And you may remember that in many cases now, we're finding that the association of PCR to survival is not as clean as we would like it to be. And I think we need to do some work on sort of how do we translate PCR advantages and how do we interpret those. I mean, this is going to be very important for us as we're using neoadjuvant studies to inform and, you know, someday I think people are hoping to replace very large adjuvant studies. But there's going to have to be a much clearer quantitative relationship and interpretable relationship of PCR advantages to event-free survival. That said, it was higher. Right? It absolutely was higher. If the patient's tolerating it, I think it's a very reasonable choice. And, you know, in the era where checkpoint inhibitors may come to play, you know, nab-paclitaxel avoids steroids, and that may be a very advantageous approach. You know, that setting us up for the future studies, I think that's a very reasonable. It certainly wasn't worse. It might be better. We just don't know from a survival standpoint.
And actually, I was just going to ask you about checkpoint inhibitors, specifically anti-PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies. We saw some more data on that at San Antonio. Where do things stand today with using checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer, specifically triple negative disease?
You know, I think they're very promising. You know, we've had a couple of studies that are, again, these are small phase one studies, was presented at San Antonio, you know, with avelumab. Pembrolizumab has been presented previously. I think there's a general consistency with this class of drugs that they seem to have an effect in a subset of these patients. So the response rate is not very high, but it's very durable. And, you know, this fits, right? The biology of triple negative breast cancer, you know, as we're increasingly recognizing, this is a group of diseases. This is not one disease. And so it's really a misnomer in a biologic respect. There's a subset of triple negatives that seem to have an activated immune system. There's a subset that do not. And whether or not those are the ones that are responding to these drugs is as yet uncertain, but it wouldn't surprise me if these are the kinds of variations we need to get more sophisticated about.
So another topic related to triple negative disease is choice of taxane. And at the satellite meeting, you discussed the big phase 3 neoadjuvant German trial looking at nab-paclitaxel. Can you comment on that?
So the GBG study looking at nab-paclitaxel was very interesting. So it was really a straight-up comparison of paclitaxel versus nab-paclitaxel given weekly as part of a sequential taxane anthracycline regimen. And what they found in the overall trial was a modest increase in PCR rates with the nab-paclitaxel. Within the subset that was triple negative, that impact was far greater. It was an absolute benefit, closer to 15%. You know, there's a cost. So there was a higher PCR rate, but there was also higher toxicity. There was a higher discontinuation rate. There was higher sort of requirements for dose reductions. This is very consistent with the metastatic setting. So, you know, my take on it, since we don't have survival data yet, is that nab-paclitaxel in the neoadjuvant setting is a reasonable option, but not a mandatory one. There's a price to be paid, and we don't know whether it's going to translate into an improvement in relapse and survival. And until we know that, it's going to be an option. The main interest in this, and I have to say one of the reasons why it's coming up, is because it may well be that in the era of immune checkpoint inhibitors, a drug that doesn't require concurrent steroids may be very appealing. So while today I think you can choose to use it or not without it having any negative consequences, I think in the future it may be a preferred option, but we'll have to wait and see.
So another topic that we talked about related to triple negative breast cancer is the use of antiandrogens, and there was a lot of interest in the general oncologist about that. Can you talk about where we stand today with that and also in terms of assays for androgen receptor?
Yeah. You know, I think anything that gives us an opportunity to get away from cytotoxic chemotherapy is, of course, very exciting in the triple negative sphere. I think, you know, this is sort of the same story of why are people so excited about immune checkpoint inhibitors. So the truth is there are now a couple of studies that have targeted the androgen receptor in triple negative breast cancer. There was a relatively small phase 2 study using bicalutamide that was published a year or so ago, in which there was about a 20%, not quite, clinical benefit rate in triple negative breast cancer that was AR positive using an immunostain. However, there was, it took, you know, hundreds of patients to find the 25 or so that went on the study. They used a pretty rigorous immunostain criterion. And it's also true that it's an uncontrolled study, so how much is disease biology and how much was drug is also unclear, but being stable for 6 months is something to consider. The most recent one is an enzalutamide study, and that was a larger study, about 90 or so patients, of which about 75 were evaluable, and it had a clinical benefit rate that was actually closer to 30%. Particularly in those that had a gene expression signature that suggested an androgen receptor-driven subset of triple-negative breast cancer, in which it was almost 40% compared to 10% that those were negative for the AR signature. It's very exciting. Again, you know, we have to be very careful because all that could say is that this gene signature picks up patient with more indolent biology. It doesn't necessarily say that the drug was causing that prolonged disease control. And it is also worth noting there's not a very high response rate. So again, how much of this is disease and how much of this is drug has to be determined. But anything, again, this is well-tolerated, non-cytotoxic chemotherapy, and I think extremely exciting.
Have you yourself had any patients in your practice treated either on or off study with an antiandrogen?
Yeah, well, we participated in the phase 2 study, so I had patients on that study.
Were there any patients that you felt benefited clinically or had objective responses that you've seen yourself?
No, I didn't have any responses, and that to me is the clearest evidence of drug activity. I did have patients who had sort of pokey disease, but it's unclear to me whether that was the nature of the disease as opposed to the drug.
So the last thing I want to ask you about in terms of triple negative disease is because there's really no target, I mean, with ER positive and HER2 positive disease, you know, there's so many trials and new agents and things that are out there, but with triple negative metastatic disease, it's not uncommon to pretty quickly go through the available approved therapies and not have very much options. And sometimes the patients are in good condition and want to be treated. And this question comes up in a lot of solid tumors, which is the question of multiplex assays or next generation sequencing. What are your thoughts about doing that type of an assay in that situation?
Well, you know, we've been actually doing this for a couple of years now, and I think ours and others have found more or less the same thing. In triple negative disease, you're actually likely to find a lot of P53 mutations. a smattering of PI3 kinase mutations, and just, it's, if anything, less likely to come up with what people might consider actionable genomic findings than, say, ER-positive HER2-negative disease. So that's a disappointment. I do think that for the most part, next-gen sequencing is still a work in progress and a promissory note. I think it does help sometimes guide into basket or umbrella trials, and I think that's an appropriate use of them. At the moment, I haven't found a compelling off-trial clinical use for it, particularly in the triple-negative setting.